and Camino with Kit Hogg.
Now, you might say that he hit the ground running. You might even say that he was running before he hit the ground, before the inauguration last Monday. President-elect, you're joking. Trump has been noising off as though he were already in the White House since November. Having worked up such a head of steam, it's hardly surprising that he is torn into Washington like an orange tornado. Here with his impressions of the first days of a nascent presidency, our man in New Jersey, Andy Wood. Andy, good morning to you.
Good morning, Kit. Good morning, TRE. How are you today?
We're good, thank you. Yes, we're good. MC, are you good?
Yes, I'm good. Morning.
Good. And you asked me the other day how I was, and I told you I was cold, and you said, no, you're not, because on the eastern seaboard of the United States, it's so cold that for the first time in how many years, the inauguration of the new president had to be held indoors. And what were your impressions of that inauguration?
Yes, it was. I think they moved it indoors back in the 80s for weather, but it's traditionally outside and lots of people come, hundreds of thousands of people come. Today, just as a point of reference, I'm in central Jersey. I'm near the ocean, which tends to keep the temperature up a little bit, but it's minus 12 right now. So it's been a bitter cold polar vortex type of weather over the last week, and that really changed the inauguration, but they just moved it inside. And my impression was that it was a lost opportunity, really. President Trump just gave it was a campaign speech. It wasn't really an inauguration address. You've got all of living presidents there. You've got Bush, Clinton, Obama, and Biden, and he's up there talking about a corrupt and failed system, and he's the only person who can save it. It was nothing really aspirational for people to be optimistic about. He's always been a little dystopian. This is terrible. Everything's terrible, despite, you know, the stock market going up over 50% during Biden's reign. Unemployment, new low. And I don't think he really made any effort to reach out to the 50% of Americans who didn't vote for him. Probably more than 50%, actually. He was really just throwing more red meat to the MAGA crowd. I think it was a lost opportunity.
Felt like divisive rhetoric to me. It felt like divisive rhetoric to me. That you paint a dark picture and you cast yourself as the savior. But you mentioned the previous presidents. I mean, how face-clawing it must have been for particularly Joe Biden to be sitting there. I didn't see it. I was listening to it on the radio, but I was imagining being there listening to this diatribe of almost insults. And he must have been feeling like some sort of captive in humiliation. But I guess that's the mask you have to put on.
Exactly. They have pretty thick skins. I mean, they arrive at the inauguration together, their wives and them in the same limo. So, somebody asked them what they talked about, and basically they talked about football.
Right. Okay. Well, at least they talked, and they'd had tea together as well, or something. I mean,
yeah, that's another tradition. And then the other tradition is that the new president walks the old president to the helicopter. But they probably can't say much because it's probably noisy. But yeah, I mean, they make polite conversation. I mean, they respect these traditions. They're not going to punch each other or show up. They respect the traditions that have been done this way for 100 years. So.
But all this is taking place against the backdrop of this animosity of Biden's pardons and the threat of Trump going after people, with his executive orders. I heard today actually that Joe Biden, Trump had hinted that Biden had pardoned his family, but he'd left himself, Joe Biden, unpardoned. I mean, how likely is Trump to come after him? And what does this potential for weird vengeance say about America?
Yeah, it's interesting. The ability of a president to pardon goes back to old English common law, actually. The founders didn't want the president to not have the same authority and powers as the king. So in the Constitution, they were granted the ability to pardon. And traditionally, they always do. In their last week, they will pardon a lot of perhaps people who are in jail for minor offenses. Because the cannabis laws changed, they released a lot of people who would now not go to jail for marijuana cannabis offenses. So it's been a long tradition. The fact that President Trump, when he was campaigning, was saying he was going to put all these people in jail, but he had an enemies list. And I think that really forced Biden's hand to do pardons in advance, which is a little bit of an odd concept.
Yeah, preemptive pardoning. That just sounds, odd.
Well, and also, I mean, at the same time, President Trump has released all 1,600 people in jail who stormed the Capitol. And that's causing quite a lot of concern, even among Republicans, because some of these people, they hit policemen with one of them hit one with a chair, one through sprayed policemen with hairspray in their eyes. I mean, physically assaulting police officers, and they were all let go. And Trump referred to them as hostages and political prisoners. So they all walked out of jail yesterday.
Mm.
And 1,600 of them. So.
Mm. Mm.
So that was quite a large pardoning. So, it was an en masse pardon.
So, and this was all part of this thing called executive orders. And there's been a few executive orders. There's been the pardons, there's been America First, there's been withdrawing from the World Health Organization, there's been the withdrawal from Paris Agreement, to name but some of them. But what constitutional, what legal bearing status do they have, these executive orders, which seem to come directly from the president without consultation or any approval of Congress?
Yeah, it is odd. They're not legislation, but they become law. They're not legislation.
Do they become law? They don't have to be ratified. Are they unchallenged,
no,
for example?
Yeah, they don't go through the legislation. So they're, through the they don't go through Congress.
Right, right. But can they be challenged?
They can only be. Yeah, they can be challenged in the courts. They can only be related to federal resources, which is vague and gives one quite a large sway. So you're correct. One of the things he's rolling back, the energy regulations on refrigerators and light bulbs and things in the name of consumer choice. Now I want to burn more inefficient electricity. So he did all sorts of weird things. He's fired or reassigned over 1,000 federal employees. It's kind of crazy. And like you say, pulled out of the Paris Climate Accord immediately and declared a state of emergency at the border. And that's another a tool, if you like the executive order. And by declaring a state of emergency, it frees up funds, and it gives allows the military to be brought in, or the National Guard to assume duties. We're under a state of emergency in New Jersey right now. It was declared by the governor on Sunday, and really there's not people dying or people's houses going or anything. It was just cold, but by declaring state of emergency, it means that bring more resources, authorize overtime for plow drivers and access federal funds. So it's a tool, and he's using it at the border to now be able to have funds to build the wall, send the army down, do whatever. One of these executive orders, and he signed several at the inauguration. He traditionally goes to three different inauguration balls, and in between he would sit down and sign them. So immediately he started signing them. One of them that I thought was really mean-spirited, really, and unnecessary, was back when he was president before, they had a policy of separating children immigrant children from their families, and they thought that would be a deterrent, and it didn't really work, and there was a lot of children just separated and lost in the system. So Biden instituted a group to work to reunite these families, and he shut down that working group, which I just thought, I just see, like, don't you want children to be with their families? And they estimate there's still 1,000 plus children who are lost in this system. And nobody now is working to find their parents. So I thought that was a little unnecessary.
Hmm. Andy, tell us about the cryptocurrency that he and Melania have launched.
Yeah, so crypto, and I can't get too in the weeds in this because I don't fully understand the whole thing myself. But within the crypto sphere, in the ecosystem, there are things called meme coins, which are based on a joke or a meme. The most popular one is something that was launched a couple of years ago called Fartcoin, and that currently has a $1.5 billion market cap. So people do trade in these things, but they also have another rather unpleasant name, rhymes with Bitcoin, because people on the inside see them as very volatile. They fluctuate like crazy. Well, first, if you put $Trump, there's now a meme coin that you can invest in, a cryptocurrency that he launched. At the same time, his wife launched $Melania crypto coin. So you can trade in these coins on the crypto exchanges.
How are they doing? Is this proved to be a good investment initially?
I think it would be a very, very, very unwise investment. Who knows with crypto in general, right? People have made billions, people have lost hundreds of millions, so who knows? But it does seem, it's just another way to basically bring money into the Trump orbit. And they're very good at raising money.
I heard that Bitcoin had risen exponentially since he came in.
Ecosystem sees Trump as being more crypto friendly. He a couple of years ago he didn't really understand it and said he thought it was a scam, but now he's sort of attracted some crypto billionaires as donors, and they see that he'll perhaps be more lenient with regulation and be a bit more crypto friendly. So Bitcoin went up. Yeah, that's true.
And talking of donors, tell us about the fundraising dinner that he wasn't even there. Was JD Vance was there?
Right, a couple of crypto bros were there. So it was interesting. It was in Palm Beach last week, prior to the inauguration, and it was Don Jr. and Vance, the Vice President Vance. Don Jr. is really a good friend of Vance's, and he promoted him apparently to his father to be his vice president. They hosted a dinner in a restaurant in Palm Beach, and if you and I wanted to go, it would cost us $500,000. It was $250,000 a plate to attend. They said that it raised over seven figures, so I'm guessing it was 40 to 50 people there. I did see a shortened guest list. None of the people in my orbit, but a couple of crypto people, some tech giants, And it was basically a coming, it was two things, I think, or three things. One, raised a ton of money. Two, it was a coming together of the old school Republican billionaire donors and the new kind of tech crypto donors. So it was a way to mix those. And it also was, I think, if you like, a very early shot of Vance's ascension to the presidency. President Trump can't run again. He's forbidden in the Constitution. You can only run twice. Mm. So I think that it's a way to say, look, I am the heir apparent.
Okay, and at $250,000 per seat, you would imagine drinks were included.
I would think that drinks and gratuities were probably included, and I would imagine that the wine was rather good, I would think.
Right, good. Let's talk Trump's foreign policy, because this is what makes us slightly edgy here in Europe. There's an apparent spectrum of opinion within the new administration that contains prioritizers, primacists, and isolationists. Can you explain these briefly, Ant?
Yeah, so that's a good way to look at it. And with Trump's foreign policy, he's a reed in the wind, right? He says things one day and different things another day. But basically, what he's saying is, a quote of his was, instead of taxing our citizens to enrich other countries, we will tariff and tax foreign countries to enrich our citizens. So that's his sort of primary base. So he's starting off with Canada and Mexico, and apparently February 1st, we're going to see tariffs on goods from those two major, major trading partners. But philosophically, it's hard to know where he falls, because he is vague, but within his orbit, he has people who prioritize, and they argue that Trump should lead on Ukraine so that U.S. can focus on China. But when you look at somebody like Rubio, who's his Secretary of State, they see value in U.S. leadership abroad. They think that, you know, spreading the example of liberal democracy, the rule of law is valuable. So they're considered, they're sort of under the umbrella of primacists. And then there's isolationists. It's America first, America alone. And he has many of those within the party. So it would be interesting to see how all that plays out.
Yeah, so on the isolationist theme, there's a recent article by Michael Ignatieff, the former leader of the Canadian Liberal Party, who's speculating, basically, is Trump's plan like a game of Risk, really, to carve up the world? Understandably concerned Canadian, he writes that he may be looking to the future, to a world where the writ of the rules-based international order no longer runs, and where power over the global economy has devolved into three zones of influence: the Chinese in East Asia, the Russians in Eurasia, and the Americans, with an exclusive sphere of influence in the Western Hemisphere, stretching from Greenland in the Arctic to Chile at the southern tip of Latin America. Is this how to make America great again? He says, hegemon over a bicontinental sphere of influence with the U.S. homeland at its heart. This just might be Trump's quid pro quo for accepting Russian and Chinese spheres of influence and letting India tack between the two. Accepting their spheres of influence, provided they recognize his, would allow him to cut the Gordian knot that has tied America's strategic interests to Europe for so long, which would definitely put the shiver. I mean, Europe has to take responsibility for its own future. It's ridiculous how Europe operates within American, or has operated within, American security bubble. But does that Just how do you react to that? The world is kind of split into three zones of influence, and Trump's very happy with his empire, which basically includes Greenland, Canada, and a sort of Monroe Doctrine sphere of South America.
Yeah, I think that that's a pretty dystopian view.
It's an extreme isolationist view, isn't it? I mean, you basically...
It's a depressing view of the world. I think it's depressing. It's a lot more complicated, right, than just these three blocks, because the feeling within the current administration is that China's the enemy, and China needs to be reined in. We need to focus on China. Move our focus away from Russia. Let Europe deal with Russia. We'll focus on China. Hence the tariffs. Hence the talk of the Panama Canal. The reason that the Panama Canal keeps coming up, he said categorically, we're taking back the Panama Canal, was because it's managed by a Hong Kong-based company, I think called Hutchinson or something. Mm-hmm. The ports at either end are managed by a fundamentally Chinese company. So that's caused huge alarm bells. Plus the fact that there's some issues with the administration of the Panama Canal. They're running out of water. They use an awful lot of water, millions of gallons to raise just one boat. So I think putting it all together, I don't think one person in 4 years can undo that Gordian knot. I don't think that's possible. I think it's impervious to the tinkering of one man over 4 years. But I believe that they are going to turn their focus to containing China, and there will be partnerships and alliances with others, possibly in Europe, not just South America or Latin America, to that end, to make sure that China, the sphere of influence, is restricted.
And moving away from, just to cheer ourselves up a little, I know you've, moving away from the US, let's come to Europe. And I know you spent New Year in Copenhagen, a great European capital. I spent my New Year in Berlin. I've spoken about that on this show. But just give us a very brief impression of Copenhagen that New Year. It must have been really quite different for you.
Yeah, actually it was Christmas. We went over Christmas, and Christmas is a three-day holiday in Denmark, and often the gifts exchanged on Christmas Eve. So I learned that. So some shops and restaurants stay open, but mostly they're closed on Christmas Day. I've been to Denmark several times, and everybody there is tall, beautiful, bilingual, and friendly. Right. It really is a great place to visit.
It sounds a bit uniform. Is it actually quite boring?
No, it's not boring. I would say I like the architecture there. They've preserved a lot of that old European style in downtown Copenhagen, in a capital city. It's very, very clean. It wasn't overly expensive. I was surprised. You could eat well for a reasonable price. And I just found it delightful and very restful.
Well, that's great, man. You had Christmas there. Very nice. With the family.
And a lot of bicycles. It's the most bicycle-friendly city in the world.
Yeah.
I'm thinking of
Holland a little bit, yeah. I imagine it.
It's kind of Amsterdam vibe.
Yeah. Listen, man, that's where we're going to have to leave it. It's been a pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much for your time.
No problem. You have a great weekend, Kit.
Andy Wood with another inimitable letter from New Jersey. Bye-bye for now.